It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, which news stories do you think Republicans and Democrats heard the most about in 2019? There are some distinct differences. We'll look at the lists and what they say about how the parties stay informed. First, it's the season to think about some of your favorite things of the year as best of lists appear everywhere. We'll do a few of our own and invite you to join in with your favorites. The young adult genre of books has taken off in the last decade or so, with many more authors writing to this audience. And don't be fooled, teens and adults alike can enjoy these books. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read any young adult books, past or present, that you've really enjoyed? Do you have a favorite young adult author? Or maybe you need a recommendation. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got two librarians with us to share some great young adult books for 2019. Amanda Geske is the Community Engagement Librarian at the Meadow Ridge Branch of Madison Public Library. Amanda, thanks for coming up.
Thanks for having me here.
And Megan Schliessman is a librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Megan, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Well, Megan, what makes something a young adult book?
What makes it a young adult book? Well, I would say, first of all, the audience of intent that an author is writing to, which is typically middle high school age, though, as you said, often then we have a lot of adults who are interested in it. The themes tend to be a little bit more mature, I would say. Sometimes the outcomes aren't always as positive as we might expect from a children's book. Not that children's books don't have complexities and also address hard things sometimes, and that's the reality of lives. But I think audience and content both can be part of what defines a young adult book.
And Amanda, do you see a lot of demand for young adult books coming through your doors at your library branch?
We definitely do. Like you said, it's really hitting its heyday right now, where people of all ages are interested. I think that really exciting covers are being made, where we're seeing a lot more diversity and a lot of like risk-taking in YA lit. That's really exciting no matter what you're interested in.
And there's been this explosion of it. I don't know how anybody could keep up with all of it, but it seems like not that long ago we were doing shows on this weird new subcategory called young adult books, and there were three or four authors. That's not true anymore, is it?
Oh, and it hasn't been true for a while, but I think Amanda just mentioned diversity, and one of the really exciting things we're seeing now is more and more new voices who are Black and Indigenous and people of color, and that is a really wonderful, welcome, necessary dimension of the young adult publishing right now.
Well, I don't want to wait too long. We promised some suggestions here for people, so let's get into it. You shared a list with us, and you can you two can take it where you want for some of your top picks for 2019. Where do you want to go, Amanda?
Well, we happen to have about 30, so I don't know if we're going to get to them.
probably not.
So 2019 has been a really fun year for series, I think. And so this is the year I decided to read harder and I came into fantasy series. And so there are two fantastic ones that I love. One is Holly Black's Folk of the Air series. And so this one is about a young girl who is immortal and she's taken from her home and raised in the High Court of Fairies. And so this is where, if you're not a fantasy head, you might drop off, but don't yet. Because it really quickly turns into this really fun trilogy of like court intrigue and deceptions and power struggles. It's like this Game of Thrones, like House of Cards in a YA book. And there's plenty of bloodshed. And it is just like one of the best of 2019.
Okay. And what do you want to start us off with, Megan?
Well, I will jump off of that. The fantasy genre, this is a standalone fantasy called Stepsister by Jennifer Donnelly. And it is a sort of a sideways retelling of the Cinderella story with a feminist slant. And it really focuses on the two stepsisters, the quote-unquote ugly stepsisters, who we learn in this book were once really close with Ella. But they grew really bitter because they're not traditionally beautiful. They have very non-traditional female interests. Isabel, the main character, is interested in military strategy. Her sister Tavi is really immersed in the world of math and science. And they both have been treated very poorly because of that. And it comes full circle in a wonderful way, including the fact that those skills are absolutely necessary for the resolution of this very action-driven plot.
We're looking at the young adult books of 2019. We have Amanda Geske and Megan Schliessman with us from Madison Public Library and the UW-Madison's Cooperative Children's Book Center, respectively. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite young adult books, old or new, ones you've read yourself or shared with your teens. Or if you have a question about a recommendation, 800-642-1234. Let's check out some of the other ones on your list. Love from A to Z by S.K. Ali. And I'll say, before the show, I was peeking around at some other people's best of 2019 young adult lists. And this is one that I saw on at least a couple of them.
It is a wonderful book, and it is, on the one hand, a love story. We meet Zainab, who is West Indian Pakistani American, and we meet Adam, who is Chinese and white. These are two Muslim teens who meet in the London airport, and they recognize that they each have a journal called Marvels and Oddities, which is named for a piece of Islamic art that's very inspirational to both of them. And they're both dealing with some pretty intense things in their personal lives. And so one of the things I love is both how their relationship develops, and they're really getting to know each other as individuals, navigating how they can be supportive of each other. And then to see this love story developing in the context of two teens for whom falling in love and how they behave is defined in a really wonderful way by their Muslim faith.
And yeah, we started off looking at some fantasy ones. This one's more in the realistic fiction genre. Amanda, anything else in that line that you would point to? I think actually a fair amount on your list that you two provided are fit into that category.
Yes, a ton. So I think one of the things that can happen with YA books is that people kind of underestimate it of romance or just kind of being trite. And I think that's something really exciting that's happening in YA is where you take on bigger themes in that. So one of my other favorites is Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Rebai. And so this is a book that will like break your heart and then rebuild it in the best way possible. And so it's a coming of age story about this kid, Jay, who's ready to just coast through his summer break. And it turns out that his Filipino cousin was murdered in President Duterte's like really bloody war on drugs. And so when he's trying to ask his family about what happened, he's not getting satisfying answers. And so he flies down to the Philippines to try to get more answers there. And it ends up being this really big story about learning more about his cousin's life and what role he himself had in his cousin's death. And it is this thing of like teens are really interested in current events and where to take that. And so these kind of classic storylines, you're really building these things that add a degree of realism.
And this is an author, I think, born in the Philippines, but who moved ultimately to the Midwest, right?
Which is very much what the character that is reflected in this character in that novel, yes.
Do we have a good young adult scene, author scene in the Midwest or even closer to home here in Wisconsin?
Oh, she's going to make me answer that. We do. We absolutely have some YA authors here in Madison. Emily Cokey comes to mind. There are others in the area. And, of course, we're close to Chicago and the Twin Cities, so there are quite a few. But, of course, the names are all escaping me as we sit here.
Well, let's turn to graphic novels now. You shared one with us. Before we get into a particular one, is graphic novel, as you see it in your library, Amanda, a big genre for young adult?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really fun entry place, especially, you know, we toss around the phrases reluctant reader or something like that. This is a great entry point.
And the one you put on your list, Laura Dean Keeps Breaking Up With Me by Mariko Tamaki. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Tamaki.
Tamaki. Yeah. Okay. Oh, I have it spelled wrong here. That's why.
That would help. Yeah. So that one is another really fun book. So our main character, Freddie, is dating this really popular, funny person at school, but it turns out it's a really trash relationship and she should really get out of it. And so in this book, we're living the 2019 mantra of like, dump the zero, get with the hero. And so we're bringing in like advice columnists. We're bringing in mediums, and that's where she figures out what I really need to be doing is like doubling down on my friendships and getting out of this nasty relationship. And it is so beautifully done.
That's something probably a lot of people can relate to, not just teens.
Absolutely. That was something we talked about a lot when we read it at work.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Jim with us in Fort Atkinson. Jim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Good. Well, I think this is an awesome topic, especially this time of year, people looking for gifts. I was a teacher for 40 years. About half of that was at the middle school level. And I would like to tout two authors, Gary Paulson and J.K. Rowling, both kind of old school at this point, but somebody that really sucks in a reader. especially reluctant readers. So thanks for tackling the subject. You guys have a good day.
Jim, thank you so much for that call. Megan, J.K. Rowling, of course, the Harry Potter books brought a lot of people into reading, I think. Gary Paulson, I'm not as familiar
Gary Paulson has written a lot of sort of outdoor adventure survival books. So there's certain readers who find them especially compelling, and they tend to be short and really fast-paced, which is also really wonderful.
Any other good reluctant reader ones at that age, Amanda, that you'd point us toward?
Yeah, I think reluctant readers really love this concept of like a series, right? So if you can get a kiddo to buy into this series that they have got like 30 books laid out for them. So I think about like J.K. Rowling is actually a really good example of in the library the other day, I heard it called a throwback series, which just about... I can't even imagine it being that old.
Makes us all feel really old.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing, and there are a lot of series out there, but I'm actually going to jump off the series bandwagon
okay.
a minute for reluctant readers and say, I think what's probably one of the most important things you can do for reluctant readers is think about what they're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be that they're interested in nonfiction topics. So really look for that point of interest. Every kid and every reader is different. And so that's where we always start when we're trying to answer those questions and come up with some ideas.
We're talking to Megan Schliessman and Amanda Geske, both in our studio with us, talking about the best young adult books of 2019. Amanda is the community engagement librarian at the Meadow Ridge branch of Madison Public Library. Megan is a librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center of the School of Education at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy reading young adult books, or does someone close to you? Do you have a favorite book or author you'd like to share with us? Do you have any favorites for the new year, or do you need a recommendation? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with two librarians looking at great young adult books of 2019. Amanda Geske is community engagement librarian at the Meadow Ridge branch of Madison Public Library. Megan Schliessman, librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center at UW-Madison School of Education. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to share a young adult book, new or old, with us? Do you have a favorite author? Is this a genre you love to read, whatever age you may be? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, I want to go back to your list. Hot Dog Girl by Jennifer Dugan. Sounds like what it says on the tin. It's about the hot dog girl.
It is indeed about the hot dog girl. So our main character is this really beautiful, like, queer rom-com. And so our main character is getting ready for her best summer ever, where she is indeed the hot dog girl at the carnival.
So she's dressed as a hot dog.
Correct. Exactly. And you might think that would be mortifying. She is jacked. She's ready for it. And so things really go awry quickly when she sets up this elaborate love triangle with, I think it's called the diving pirate Nick and her other best friend, who all have these identities at the carnival. And of course, in very YA fashion, they have this elaborate setup, and then things start actually building. They start actually falling in love. And it's just a really fun, funny book to go through that you're feeling all these emotions along with them.
And how about Dig by A.S. King?
Oh, talk about a really different book. Dig by A.S. King is taut and mesmerizing. It has teenage characters with names like The Shoveler and Can I Help You? And The Ringmaster. And older adult characters, Marla and Gottfried. They're probably in their 70s. And then the connecting character through all of them is a teenager called The Freak, who is literally flickering in and out and tunneling in and out of their lives. It is a book that looks at race and violence and misogyny in a way that is incredibly deep and rich, and you think about it and need to talk about it
Wow.
for a really long time.
Well, let's go back to our callers now. Robert joins us in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to throw out the author Brandon Sanderson and his Mistborn series. He happened to be an author where I really wasn't into fantasy or young adult novels, as a 33-year-old male myself, but those books really pulled me in. I couldn't put them down, and I've been a fan of the author ever since.
Robert, I'll jump in on this one. I just finished the second book in the Mistborn series as a slightly older than 33-year-old male. I didn't even register that it was young adult, though I can see that now you mention it. I have enjoyed it. My wife enjoyed it. We'll be proceeding onward. So I'll back Robert up on that one. Have you, anybody want to jump in?
It's not my genre.
it's definitely fantasy, and I think he does some science fiction. He's
right.
In that world, definitely.
Right, but I know other people who are huge fans as well.
And I think there's something of, like, if you're new to fantasy, getting into something that's a series that takes a mm-hmm. little more time to build the world makes a lot of sense. I'm going to throw in one other book from this year that kind of follows that vein. So there's the Children of Blood and Bone series by Tomi Adeyemi. And so it's set up as a very classic epic story, where it draws from West African gods and goddesses as your backstory. And our main character is on a quest. Her people perform magic, and there was this ruthless king who was power hungry and wanted to get rid of magic all across. And so he set out on this thing to kill everyone from her people and run everyone underground. And so it's this really beautiful coming of age story where she's trying to find her power and help bring that into light and where to use that whenever possible. And then it really builds that world of drawing on that epic tradition. And of course, there's a really great romance story where she's in love with, like, her sworn enemy.
So it has it all.
Of course, it has everything that you need.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Back to our callers now. Jen is with us in Madison. Jen, hi.
Hi. I'm loving this conversation, so thank you guys so much. I was thinking about when the Divergent series came out, there was also another series called Delirium. And I feel like Divergent completely overshadowed Delirium, but I love Delirium way more, and I wish they would have actually made the movie series after that book series rather than Divergent.
And Jen, for people who are looking for that one, Delirium, who's the author again?
I'm not sure, and I'm driving in the car, but it's just a book that I go back and I reread them often because they just pulled me in so much more than Divergent.
Okay, my producer says Lauren Oliver would be the author of the Delirium series. Thank you so much, Jen. Yeah, a lot of times these genres, young adult books, seem to find their way into the theaters. Do you see, Amanda, people coming in, seeing the movie and say, hey, I want to check out the book now?
Absolutely. And we're having this really exciting time with Marvel and Black Panther and where we're seeing this kind of re-envisioning of where these kind of classic stories are going, and that is such a great opportunity.
Yeah, and I would add on that, in fact, what we're seeing now is young adult literature responding to the Marvel Universe, and now they are creating novels with really great authors based on those characters from the Marvel Universe, like Jason Reynolds' Spider-Man. And
we are talking about young adult books with Amanda Geske and Megan Schliessman. Back to your calls now. Patrick is with us in Milwaukee. Patrick, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to mention one of my favorite young adult authors, John Christopher.
And what would be a title or a series name, Patrick?
He does sort of allegoric fantasy.
Allegoric fantasy, okay.
Yeah, it's very deep and very, it has a certain spiritual message to it. I read it during middle school, and he did the Tripods trilogy and the Lotus Caves.
Okay. Patrick, thank you so much for that suggestion. We just have a few minutes left, and I want to get through some more of the ones from your lists now. You've got a nonfiction one by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. She was on the show, actually, a few years back to talk about an Indigenous people's history of the United States. I think that was the book we had her on for. There's one now for young people I didn't know about.
It's the Young Readers Edition, adapted by Jean Mendoza and Debbie Reese, and this is not for every young adult reader, but I would say for many and certainly the majority, this is a perspective shifting look at U.S. history. And instead of looking at U.S. history through the lens of American exceptionalism, which is typically how it's taught, it's really saying, look at it from an indigenous perspective, which is really a story of colonialism and oppression and treaty breaking and really attempted genocide. And it does it in a way that is not lecturing. The way this was done was really, it's really an invitation to think about it this way. And the last chapter looks at the Standing Rock protests a couple of years ago and really brings the whole framework of the book right up to the present day.
And another one on the list, David Yoon, a book called Frankly in Love, which is a very literal title because the main character's name is Frank Lee, L-I, right?
Yes, it is a really amazing debut young adult novel. It is a love story on the one hand, but it is really about this first-generation Korean-American who is confronting a lot of things in his own family, including his own parents' racism. His best friend is black. He doesn't feel comfortable having his best friend over. His older sister has married an African-American man and basically is persona non grata to his parents. And when he starts dating a white teenager, he realizes, I can't tell them this, so he decides to fake date another first-generation Korean-American, thinking it will make all our parents happy. What could go wrong? So it is funny, and yet it confronts racism and so many other issues, including family and learning about things about your own family, who you're struggling with, and opening your eyes in new ways.
It's a big picture, Amanda. If there's people out there listening thinking, hey, I want young adult books for myself, for my kid, whatever, is it okay to just go into the library and ask a librarian, give some, hey, I like this, I like this, I like this, so what should I read?
Absolutely. You'll make that librarian's day. Absolutely.
Yeah, and is it just a simple, like as easy as I like these books or I like these subjects, and then playing getting a matchmaker, I guess, in the library?
Yes, that is exactly right. So we will ask all kinds of questions, especially we're talking about these reluctant readers. We'll ask, like, what is kiddo come home talking about each day? What are the movies that mm-hmm. they like? What kind of games are they playing right now? And we are trained and really excited to build on that.
We'll leave it there for now. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Megan, thanks for coming up.
Thanks.
Amanda Geske is a community engagement librarian at the Meadow Ridge branch of Madison Public Library. Megan Schliessman is a librarian at the Cooperative Children's Book Center of the School of Education at UW-Madison. They both joined us with their picks for the best young adult reads of 2019. Conversation doesn't have to stop there. If you have a favorite that you want to share and recommend, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe somebody's looking for the book that you like. Coming up after the news, we'll look at which news stories were most likely to break through to voters in 2019 and what kind of stories were more likely to be seen by partisans of one side or another. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Evers wants the legislature's budget committee to approve millions of dollars to help Wisconsin's homeless population, but leaders of that committee say the governor doesn't have the authority to make him do that. We'll find out why coming up. First, a new report shows that the biggest news stories you heard about this year might depend on whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. Morning Consult looked at 46 of its polls that surveyed a total of about 90,000 registered voters. People were asked about what they'd seen, read, or heard about the top news of the week. At the top of both parties' lists are Hurricane Dorian, right behind it, President Trump's national emergency declaration at the U.S.-Mexico border.
We've got to get rid of drugs and gangs and people. It's an invasion. We have an invasion of drugs and criminals coming into our country that we stop, but it's very hard to stop.
From there, the top stories begin to differ. Joanna Piacenza is senior data editor for Morning Consult, and Eli Yokley is a reporter at Morning Consult who covers politics and campaigns. Joanna, thanks for joining us.
So happy to be here.
And Eli, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Joanna, let's start with you. You've done a similar report now last year and this year. What are you looking to find out in this annual analysis?
Well, you know, whenever we ask people their opinions about a number of issues, climate change, immigration, impeachment, one of the things that we like to do within polling is ask people how much they've seen, read, or heard about the news. That way, you know, we can look at the attitudes of issues of people who have heard a lot about the news. So we were thinking last year, we have a lot of these what we call seen, read, heards. So we collected them again in 2019 to look at what news penetrated where and with which partisans. So it's a fun project that we do every year that always has us thinking, wait, that happened this year? and really, really interesting to see how many people across the country really heard about the news that kind of we're obsessed with in Washington.
Well, Eli, let's start off with the top story, at least as far as what people saw, heard, or read about. Hurricane Dorian hit the Bahamas in early September, then went over to the east coast of the U.S., eventually to the northern Atlantic. Give us a recap, a sense of how big that story was and why it stood out above the crowd.
It was a big deal. I mean, these stories of death and destruction have really been able to break through in the minds of voters. About 7 in 10 heard a lot about Hurricane Dorian when it came through this year. That was followed up by the national emergency at the beginning of the year. And some of these other stories about crime and some of these shootings that really dominated the headlines this summer.
And Joanna, a lot of the stories we'll get to, I think, have a partisan divide where, you know, Democrats may have heard about it more or less than Republicans. A story like this hurricane, was there that kind of divide?
Not really. You know, we write a lot about media bubbles here at Morning Consult. If you actually go to our site and see the interactive from which this is based off of, we actually used bubbles in the interactive because we wanted to kind of show media bubbles. And one of the surprising things is that there weren't a huge amount of differences between the top news stories between Democrats and Republicans. You know, there were divisive news events, absolutely. The Trump administration's continuation to separate families at the border, Trump's attacks on McCain and kind of other lawmakers, those created a divide between Democrats and Republicans. But, you know, the bigger news stories, the hurricane, Epstein's death, even the college admission scandals, those were seen, read, and heard, you know, pretty evenly among Democrats and Republicans.
Eli, let's talk about impeachment proceedings now. And this is kind of a special story because you could say, you know, did you hear about this particular moment or impeachment, or did you hear, see, or read about impeachment overall? How do you break that down when you try to figure out where that kind of story looms in the public eye?
Well, one of the things we've learned at Morning Consult is big moments matter. And one of the biggest news moments of the year was Nancy Pelosi's announcement in support of the impeachment inquiry. Over half of voters heard a lot about that at the time. And what we saw immediately was a spike in support for it. That really was able to drive opinions. The same thing happened with Attorney General Barr's announcement about the Mueller report earlier this year. He came out, announced the report well before Robert Mueller was able to speak up. And that really solidified a lot of views about that that investigation. Some of the smaller moments in the impeachment scandal have not been able to break through to voters. One of the things we're watching in the next week here is to see how many folks hear a lot about this vote that the House is about to take tomorrow on this.
And Joanna, what he just said about what Eli just said about the Barr summary versus Robert Mueller's report and then Mueller's response to Barr later got less attention, as I understand it. So those moments do matter in shaping what people see and hear about a big story.
They do. You know, I think that when a larger moment happens within a news cycle, like the Mueller report, like the impeachment proceedings, if it's something big, it tends to really break through among voters. And then maybe there's a little bit of a drop off for these kind of smaller stories. You know, take the Me Too movement, which happened last year. Really gained traction among voters. But this year, one of the lowest penetrating news stories of 2019 was a new book that detailed 43 new allegations of sexual assault and harassment against President Trump. That, you know, would have made headlines years ago. But I think because of the way that we consume news, when something big happens, we tend to become a little bit, I don't know, used to the headlines. We hear them over and over again. And so it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. Or many news outlets simply don't report on something if the story is too long, if nothing exciting is happening in their opinion.
Talking to Joanna Piacenza and Eli Yokley, both with Morning Consult, looking at what news viewers saw, heard, and read in the year 2019. Eli, it's interesting hearing about this idea of people tuning in to particular moments. And this may be a hazard for journalists and broadcasters. We're in the constant fire hose of news, and it kind of just is all always coming at us. Is it useful, do you think, Eli, to take a step back and think about how people are actually seeing this and whether people are seeing these stories?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, these kinds of things drive narratives here in Washington. You know, we're sitting in the nation's capital today where there is a big House Rules Committee hearing happening on impeachment. And it's happening in the middle of the day, but it seems like the biggest deal in the world here in Washington. And some of these things just aren't breaking through to folks. It's a good reminder that some of these big scandals we hear about a lot aren't really penetrating to folks. One of the most interesting things was some of the smallest penetrating events were the Democratic debate, the second two Democratic debates. About 1 in 10 voters heard a lot about those, these big moments that we've thought might drive some polling and just didn't because people weren't tuning in.
And Joanna, do you think, and I know you've only been doing this for a couple of years, do you think it's different in the Trump era where it seems like there's a lot more big stories competing for attention in any given week than it might have been in the past?
Oh, my gosh. I'm not. This is entirely speculation.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm asking you to go outside the data here.
The news has not stopped over the last 2.5 years. And that's really why we started this project. You know, we are running at lightning speed just to keep up with everything. And so this is kind of a nice reflection on the year that was and, you know, the therapy that we need to have. As we deal with all these headlines and all this news, you know, it seems like it's never ending. And it does seem like it's been a lot in the last few years. I will say that.
Getting back to the partisan divide, Eli, I saw on your graphics there were some stories that were effectively non-existent for Republicans in some cases. And, you know, not every Democrat said they'd seen them, but it might be up, you know, 30, 40, 50%. Is there a breed of story that kind of fell into that category?
I mean, oftentimes the things that are more likely to make the Democrats' top list and not the Republicans' top list are critical stories about President Trump. I mean, one of the biggest ones on the Democrat list was President Trump's attacks on the late Senator John McCain this year, and that just really didn't break through. On the other hand, on the Republican side, these stories about Joe Biden's inappropriate touching, some criticism of Democrats didn't really break through as much.
People like to hear good news about their party, you know, and that's something that we've seen a lot in our polling.
And Joanna, in our last minute or so, news isn't just, you know, what is on the banner headline with the newsie saying read all about it, extra, extra. We get to pick the news we read in ways that we didn't used to be able to. We can click on this headline and not that and ignore everything else. Is that shaping some of these numbers, these divides between Democrats and Republicans?
Oh, absolutely. People tend to consume news that matches or reinforces their own ideologies, you know, and this is really reinforcing and thickening those media bubbles. I've heard critics on both sides say this is good, that these media bubbles are actually beneficial. I've heard people say that they're bad. But it's absolutely happening. People tend to believe and read news that makes them feel better about their own beliefs.
Eli, we're talking about what people saw and read in 2019. There's still 2 more weeks left. What story are you watching now to see how people are going to react or not?
I think the biggest one is impeachment. I mean, this is one of the biggest moments, probably the biggest moment in Trump's presidency. And it's going to be a story that's going to bleed into next year in a big way and merge in like a tornado with the 2020 race. So we're keeping our eye on that pretty closely.
We're going to have to update the project.
Well, I'll let you get back to work on it. Eli, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
And Joanna, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much.
Eli Yokley is a reporter at Morning Consult who covers politics and campaigns, and Joanna Piacenza is a senior data editor for Morning Consult. They put together a report on the news stories voters heard about or saw in 2019, show that Hurricane Dorian and President Trump's national emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border had the biggest reach. Coming up, we'll look at a standoff between Governor Evers and the heads of the state's Joint Finance Committee over money to fight homelessness. Stay with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about and listen to some timely folk music for the season. Now, it doesn't look like state lawmakers are going to meet this week to act on money to help the homeless. Yesterday, Governor Evers called on the Joint Finance Committee to convene on Thursday to approve $3.7 million for various homelessness relief efforts. In a letter to committee co-chairs Alberta Darling and John Nygren, Evers said that winter came early for much of the state and that, quote, the proposal was sent to the Joint Finance Committee in July specifically to avoid the current situation. The Wisconsinites most vulnerable to the harsh winter are going without the services and assistance they desperately need during the coldest months of the year. In response, Darling and Nygren wrote a letter to Evers saying there are, quote, legitimate concerns with the package of bills that need to be worked out. They also said special meetings of the committee can only be called with their approval. J.R. Ross is editor at wispolitics.com. J.R., good to have you back.
Anytime.
We'll talk about the legislation in the middle of all of this. What are lawmakers trying to do here when it comes to homelessness?
Okay, well, you got to break it down into two different parts. One, Governor Evers put a proposal in his budget to deal with homelessness, and this actually kind of grew out of this council that was created under former Governor Walker and came forth with a number of proposals. So Evers put it in his budget as a package. The Joint Finance Committee, which is controlled by Republicans, pulled that package out of the budget. Instead, Republicans worked on a package of standalone bills. But Joint Finance kept the money in its appropriation. It's an appropriation that allows the committee to require agencies to come back and request money to be released. It gives them another level of oversight. Well, that money also was basically earmarked for this package of bills. Those bills cleared the Assembly, I believe, in June, but now they're hung up before the state Senate because Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said there's a concern of the cost of this package. It's around, you know, give or take, about $3.7 million a year, so about $7.34-ish million for the two-year period. So Evers asked this summer, hey, in July, release the money. We can do it through this. These agency proposals, Joint Finance to act on it. So now he is calling on the committee to meet, and the committee is saying no.
Just to make sure I have this right, the space is there in the budget. The money is there in the budget, and it was supposed to be filled in afterward exactly what we're doing with it, either by legislation or by agencies. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and Republican lawmakers felt confident that they wanted to do this package of bills that would spend the money. They liked that approach. Now, depending on who you talk to in the Capitol, there will be people who will say that they didn't want to give the governor a quote-unquote a win by having his fingerprints on the homeless package. That said, they went this standalone legislation route. That's now hung up, and without it getting passed, either the committee has to release the money to get the stuff done, or we go through the next year and a couple months without anything being done on these proposals.
All right, there's a lot of subplots here. If we took the Assembly bill as it is and pretending it passed the Senate, signed by the governor, blah, 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 what would it do? What would be the concrete impact of it?
It covers everything from, like, housing grants to those. It covers a gamut of things, and it's all from this council that put forward these ideas of how to address the homeless problem in Wisconsin. And so I don't have the exact list in front of me, but there are a number of proposals that we dive into that would basically, you know, try and address this problem. And one of the reasons that Governor Evers asked for the committee to move ahead on the proposal from his administration was, hey, winter has kicked in. Nothing is done yet. Let's get rolling on these things and try and help these people before it gets any colder.
And that's the urgency he's highlighting in this call to the legislature, right? That this isn't just homelessness. This is homelessness in the Wisconsin winter we're dealing with now.
Yeah, and, you know, his call is unique, if not unprecedented. And this is what I mean by that. The Joint Finance Committee is a body of the legislature, okay? It's the Budget Committee. I've been up here for almost 20 years covering the Capitol. I have never seen a governor cite a state law in calling the agency, the committee, to meet. He cited a state statute that says that it shall meet at the call of the governor. Again, I've never seen that happen before. I asked the clerk of the committee. He had not seen it in 10 years he's been doing this. I asked the director of the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, which is the budget arm of the legislature. He's been there since the 1970s. He can't remember it ever happening. The governor's office doesn't remember it ever happening. This just shows you, in some ways, the dysfunction of the Capitol right now. Governor Evers is so frustrated by a lack of action by the legislature, he's trying to find unique ways to force them to act. Of course, there's also a backfire to this. The co-chairs of the committee, Alberta Darling, Republican from River Hills, John Nygren, Republican from Marinette, sent him back a letter late Monday saying that not only were they refusing to do this, but they called it basically trying to undercut their authority and said it's going to make it worse to work together. Actually, the exact wording was, such unprecedented action by your administration can only be seen as a disregard for a co-equal branch of government and will have a chilling effect on our ability to work together. That's where we're at in this body right now. They can't even agree how to do things.
Talking to J.R. Ross, editor at wispolitics.com, about a homelessness bill funding in Wisconsin. It's hung up, a dispute between the governor and state lawmakers. J.R., they talk about a chilling effect in the ability of the governor and Republicans to work together. Have we had a really warm, cuddly sort of working relationship so far?
No, not at all. And this really stems from the lame duck session, which just more than a year ago right now, its Republicans and outgoing Governor Scott Walker signed a series of changes to the authority of the governor, to oversight of the governor and the attorney general. Now, you can make an argument that there are ways that we could have avoided some of the tension, but that was the first volley, and it became an ongoing war between the legislature and the executive branch, and it just hasn't gotten any better. We've seen things like the state Senate, for example, rejecting one of Governor Evers' cabinet picks. I have never seen that happen before. I've asked people who have records going back to the 80s. They haven't seen it happen before. That is unique. We sit here in mid-December, and less than half of Governor Evers' cabinet has been confirmed. I don't remember that ever happening before. It's been a unique year, and the tensions have been high and just get higher all the time. And now, by no means is it all the legislature's fault. Governor Evers' administration has had some missteps. There was an example, there was a complaint this summer from the Evers folks because Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, and Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader in the Senate, would not meet with Maggie Gow, who was Evers' chief of staff. There was a suggestion that, look, they would meet with Governor Walker, chief of staff, as a man. This must be because they have a problem meeting with a woman. Well, that didn't sit well with people because Robin Voss, chief of staff, is a woman, for example. So the Evers folks have not done anything to kind of chill the flames. And they just kind of keep burning weekly, it seems like, in this building anymore.
Okay, but here we have this homelessness package that was come up with under a Republican administration. Now it's being pushed under a Democratic administration. Is there anybody out there saying, hey, let's fight about some other stuff? We've got this homeless package that basically everybody's on the same side on and do this thing?
Well, here's where we get some more of those layers, okay? So the problem is in the state Senate and the Republican caucus. Republicans have a 19-14 majority in the state Senate. There's a rule of thumb over there that unless you have 17 votes to pass anything from that Republican caucus, the bill basically doesn't come to the floor. The reason why, is, and this has been a long-standing rule of thumb for leaders from both parties, that basically you want to make sure if you're a majority party that you are passing things with your caucus and not the help of the minority, because once you want the minority to pass something, it emboldens the minority to ask for things. Why that's important is because as long as you have three Republicans who object to something, it kind of makes things grind to a halt. Now, I don't know how many Republicans in that caucus have a problem with the size of the spending in the homeless package. Fitzgerald has not told us. But there are enough to prevent them from that 17-vote margin to go to the floor, and that's what's holding it up. I mean, so I think if you put it on the floor tomorrow in the state Senate, it would probably pass. But it wouldn't pass those 17 Republican votes, and that's why it's not going to the floor.
Is there any indication of a joint finance meeting, whether on the governor's terms or their own, to try to make this happen?
In the letter that was sent to the governor yesterday from the co-chairs of the committee, they noted that there were legitimate concerns, kind of paraphrasing them, about the package that was identified in the legislative process that are being worked on. But what that means, I don't know, in terms of, like, is there a path to do some of it or a piece of it? Fitzgerald does not really give us an indication what the concerns are beyond the size of the spending. So we'll see. Don't forget, too, that the legislature will reconvene in January, but they're not going to be there very long. Most people guessing like January, part of February, maybe into March for the Senate, the Assembly going home in February. So there aren't going to be a lot of days on the floor this kind of late winter, early spring to do much. So I don't know if they have time in some ways to get some of the big things done. Unless, again, unless there's a compromise sometime the next month, it's going to be tough getting the floor and get out of the Senate and get on the governor's desk.
We'll keep watching this one. JR, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
JR Ross is the editor at WisPolitics.com. We talked to him about a standoff between Governor Evers and the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee. Evers wants that committee to meet this week to approve $3.7 million to fight homelessness in the state. But Republicans Alberta Darling and John Nygren say they have concerns about the funding and that special meetings called by the governor can only happen with their approval. By the way, tomorrow morning, the full House of Representatives begins debate on the question of whether to impeach President Donald Trump. Debate will be followed by a full House vote. The debate is scheduled for tomorrow, unclear when the vote will ultimately end up being. The Ideas Network will have live coverage from NPR that starts at 8 tomorrow morning. Again, tune into the Ideas Network or stream at WPR.org for live coverage with analysis from NPR, I imagine, during the breaks. That's the House impeachment debate leading up to a vote likely by the end of this week. If you're looking for that perfect, one-of-a-kind, last-minute present for someone, you're too late. It already sold, and it could have been yours for $193,750. The cape that the late Christopher Reeves wore in the 1978 movie version of Superman was sold in an auction yesterday in California. Rolling Stone magazine reports that this is now the most expensive superhero cape ever sold at auction. Not sure who's keeping track of that kind of data. To prove that the cape is the real deal, the auction lot included a copy of a Superman comic book with an ad for a trivia contest to win that cape in 1978 and a letter from DC Comics congratulating the winner. The auction page doesn't say who won the auction. We can only assume that they're wearing the cape right now, running around outside making zoom zoom sounds. Other items at auction included Dan Aykroyd's jumpsuit from Ghostbusters 2 and a Starfleet uniform worn by Patrick Stewart in Star Trek The Next Generation. Yeah, we'll go out with some Superman music. I got nothing more to say. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.